This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
Welcome to DSC's Untamed Heritage, the unique blend of hunting, conservation, and the outdoor lifestyle, delivered in an entertaining and informative fashion as only a veteran outdoorsman can do. DSC's Untamed Heritage is brought to you by DSC, Dallas Safari Club, conservation, education, and hunter advocacy. Hornady, accurate, deadly, dependable. Trigicon, brilliant aiming solutions. Ruger, rugged, reliable firearms. Burnham Brothers Game Calls, calling is calls made. Double Nickel Taxidermy, where hunting memories are preserved. Now, here's your host, Larry Wysoon.
Western Texas mule deer hunting on the Eason Ranch, got Mr. John Eason, Jeff Rice, and Luke Clayton. And these guys have been hunting along with me for the last several days, and it's a pretty interesting place you got here, Mr. Eason.
Thank you. We kind of fall in love with the place. It's special to us.
It is a special place. I mean, between all the terrain that's here, the relief in terms of the terrain, the rocks that are here, the fossils that, you know, I kind of walked around looking for this morning, picked up. And then you got whitetail and mule deer, and we've seen turkeys as well.
Turkeys, javelina, a little bit of predator hunting if you like to do that.
And I think y'all kept running like we did into porcupines as well, too.
We did. Saw porcupine, skunk.
Yeah, the hognose skunk, which is a skunk. It has no, it's just a solid white stripe all the way across. Mm-hmm. They're pretty much restricted to this western part of the country.
We got a wide variety of skunks out here. A little bit of every make and model I think there is.
Well, you showed me some photographs of a skunk that's got the most unique color pattern I have ever seen.
Almost looked mottled.
Yeah. It looked kind of like, you know, I've seen civet cats in certain parts of the world that are kind of like that, but it's just kind of a calico mottled, you know, just unbelievable color.
That's your Trans-Pecos spotted skunk.
That's the
That's what that is.
Well, we're here trying to shoot a mule deer. One of the great things about living in Texas is that we have the MLD permit, which allows landowners that qualify based upon their management programs to hunt well after the regular seasons are closed. And of course, y'all have been on a management program here for a while, and you were telling me, I think actually your brother told me that the real estate agent in this venture was Gary Robertson, who owns Burnham Brothers Game Call. Gary's a very dear friend and somebody I get to hunt with every once in a while as well, too. So y'all bought this ranch how long ago?
We've had 16 years now.
16 years.
And we've pretty much started our management program when we first bought the ranch, and high protein feed and corn. We have 17 feeders and box blinds, 1-ton feeders that keep feed to them year round.
That's going to make a difference, I'll tell you. I get tickled sometimes because a lot of folks until just more recently didn't think you could do anything with mule deer like that.
Some of these mule deer are crazy. Like I told you this morning, I had one come up to the feeder one day, and after the feeder went off, and he jumped in, took a few bites of corn, and laid down right under the feeder and went to eating. And just laid there and eating. And when I come back, I was telling some of the hunters around here about it, they laughed and told me I was crazy. And I said, well, come on, we're going to go back and watch him again. And sure enough, he come back in, and there he was. He did the same exact thing, three or four bites, laid down, went to eating.
He had it figured out. I mean, I get tickled sometimes. That's a perfect illustration as far as I'm concerned. Some of these years, well, farther east, we have a tremendous acorn crop. You know, they say if you hunt between the bedding ear and the feeding ear, and if that deer laying down and reaching out there and grabbing, you know, where it can with his mouth, if you get between that bedding ear and that feeding ear right there, you're going to be pretty close.
Yes, sir.
And that's kind of the way that mule deer was.
Yeah, he had it figured out. He wasn't wasting any energy bending over. He just laid down and got down there with it.
Well, this is an absolutely fantastic ranch. You and I have been hunting together. Guess what? First afternoon, we get out, we see a porcupine, we see a little white-tailed deer and small white-tailed or mule deer buck, and my two compadres over here that I do I get the privilege to do the Sportsman's Life TV segments with. Guess who shot a mule deer that first afternoon? How did that happen, Luke?
That was just, you know, usually old Luke is the one that's the last minute, the last day, I might get one. Well, this one, we had plenty of light. Jeff filmed this whole thing. He had a good light for the shot. I mean, probably a good 30, 40 minutes maybe before dark.
Right.
And he there was a what probably would be called a cull mule deer buck, a spike on one side and a fork, come in very cautiously. It took that deer 15 minutes to get up within where we were. Jeff spotted him out of the left side of the blind. Just a little movement, I started looking. Finally, I saw him. And he would just come to one bush and stop and look and come a little closer and stop and look. He got on in there. Well, all of a sudden, you know, those big ears went up and he started looking back in the brush. So we knew something good was about to happen. Well, something good did happen, didn't it, Jeff?
It sure did. We knew there was something out there he was watching. And all of a sudden, Luke said, there's horns. Here comes a big one. And we were just, actually, it's kind of funny because we were being entertained by two porcupines. And it's the most amazing thing, watching them climb the little feeder pens and they turn around and climb back down into the pen and start feeding on corn. And then all of a sudden that big buck came in. And
yeah, I will say this. I've hunted in Colorado, and actually me and a buddy outfitted up there for 8 years total. I was involved 7 years, elk and bear. And long, long drive for a Texan to go to Steamboat. It's about 18-hour drive, hauling all your stuff up there, and then we'd have about 500 in camp, elk and bear. Well, all that time, the mule deer were driving me absolutely nuts. Nobody drew for the tags. Nobody could legally hunt them. They just didn't do it. They were after elk and bear. So I've always had a passion for mule deer, but to have a place from Texas, I live not far from Dallas, about 30 miles, 6 hours, and I'm out here with Mr. Easton here in the Trans-Pecos area where there are mule deer. I don't have to draw a tag, you know. I can come out here, and actually, like you said, Larry, we're at the MLD time, and we're well into the new year, into I think through the third week.
Yeah, Texas, typically, most of your places, if they're not MLD, your first weekend after Thanksgiving, the hunting season opens for mule deer and runs for 2 weeks only.
Yes,
exactly.
Ours actually starts the first weekend of November during regular rifle season and runs till the third weekend of January, being we're MLD. We have a
And with whitetail, it runs into February, doesn't it?
Whitetail runs into February. Typically, we don't really hunt too much in February.
Right.
We're going to start changing our feeders over and start our protein feeding session a little earlier. Try to, like I talked to Mr. Weissoon about, trying to get bigger and better.
Yeah.
And get them started a little earlier on that program and
Well, as these bucks come out of the rut, that's such an important time for them, particularly some of the really active breeding bucks. And like in whitetail, that's usually 2-, 3-, and 4-year-old deer. And then mule deer, it's probably 3-, 4-, and 5-year-old deer, and some 2-year-old deer. And the sooner you can get those deer on a really good, sound nutrition, they have a chance to recover that much quicker.
Well, that's kind of what we're about here. We manage it hard. We whitetail deer, we try to stay at least 5.5-year-old and up. Mule deer are harder to age, so we generally go by rack, try to get the bigger, more mass, heavier racks, and and let the little fellas grow.
It makes a difference. It really does. A lot of mule deer, for years they said that mule deer had their best antlers at like 8, 9, 10 years old. And I'm still kind of subscribed to that a little bit. But the recent research that they've been doing, particularly where there's been supplemental feed involved, like on the Apache Ranch out there just north of Kent, they're finding that they're very similar to whitetail, that, 5, 4, 5, 6, and they don't need to get in those older age classes. But still, it's nice to have a bunch of those older deer in those extreme age classes, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, we've had deer that we've harvested here that, 5.5-year-old mule deer weighing 250 pounds, and it's the very first time deer. I ever met you, you told me that was unheard of in this country.
It is.
And we've got them. I mean, they're here. And as far as the whitetails go, 185-pound whitetails in West Texas desert country, and
they don't exist. They do here, but
well, we've got them, and it's because we manage hard and we feed hard.
Yes, sir.
We feed year round. A lot of the ranches they'll start a couple months ahead of the hunting season, start feeding them a little bit, getting them used to coming to the feeders again. But we feed year round. Free choice protein. We're going to start February and we'll do it till September, and then we'll swap over to our corn feeders. But it helps that protein with your little ones, with the mamas nursing.
Absolutely.
And stuff. They've got the protein going through their system that the little ones getting, so it makes them get bigger and better.
It does. There's no question about it. It's making a lot of differences on some of these places, and here, obviously, based upon what I've seen, what we've looked, records we've looked at, and oh my gracious, this is fantastic. And these are desert mule deer. These are the, it's Otocollis hemionus crookeye is the subspecies here, as opposed to the ones you find farther north up in New Mexico, parts of northern New Mexico and into Colorado. Those are Rocky Mountain mule deer. And they have a tendency to be a little bit larger anyway in body, just simply so they can make it through the harsh winters that they have here or there. But what you're doing with these deer, you're getting those deer into those same weight classes as one of those big mule deer are up there.
We're trying. I don't know that we'll ever accomplish that. I mean, but, we're giving them the best shot they can have.
And I think that's the way to do it. You're showing these deer, these are native deer. There's been no gene infusion or anything like that. These are just native deer. And to me, that's really the way that from a personal perspective, that I like to see people do things. Let's see if this native population can produce. And y'all are producing some really nice deer.
Well,
in both whitetail and mule deer.
We're a working ranch. We have sheep and we have goats, and we keep mineral and salt and sulfur blocks out to them year round. And I've had some of the biologists tell me, they won't eat that stuff. Well, I beg to differ, because I sit there and watch them do it. And it's just like our ranch over in New Mexico. We've got a ranch over there with antelope, a lot of antelope on it. And I started taking sulfur blocks over there and putting them out around there, and the biologist over in New Mexico said, antelope won't eat that stuff. I've got pictures where the blocks were gone, and they've dug holes 2 foot deep eating the dirt that was in there from it. And we've got quite a population of antelope, and we have some really big. We've harvested quite a few Boone and Crockett antelope off our ranch.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Again, you're giving those animals every opportunity to do that in terms of supplementation that what you're giving them, because a lot of times it's those little trace minerals that people don't realize can be so very important.
Right.
In terms of starting from the time that fetus starts to farm to the mother nursing that younger, and then that growth pattern of that young animal going into those older age classes. And you're doing basically, to me, the same thing in New Mexico with the pronghorn as what you're doing here, and just giving them what they need.
Right. I mean, our mineral that we put here for the sheep and goats, not like cattle, you don't pin them and work them and worm them and stuff often, and it's just not economically feasible for one thing, and it's a pain to do it for another thing in this mountain country trying to get them pinned.
Oh, my gracious.
But we put diamaceous earth. We mix it in our mineral.
Right.
And that acts as a wormer.
Yes, sir.
And so the deer's getting some of that,
absolutely,
too.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, we were driving down yesterday, and you were telling me about this one spot that where the soil had accumulated, where that may be kind of what that is.
I don't know what's in that one spot. It's up one canyon, the only place I've seen it on the ranch, but the deer go there, and there will be a hole where they just licking that soil and eating that soil.
I'll be darned.
That there's something in it. There's some kind of mineral right there in that, just that one. And you notice the soil was a lot darker.
It's totally different. Yes, sir.
Anything around it.
Totally different.
And I don't know what's there, but it's something they like.
That's interesting. I mean, I found that extremely interesting that they would come to that one spot. Maybe there's some little outcropping or something up that canyon that's leached its way down to there. And it's kind of like there's a bunch of brush and vegetation where it's kind of like a little flat area right there,
right,
where it's all accumulated.
It's in, you know, when the creek draw, dry creek bed draw there, that, like I say, something's come out of the rock somewheres and washed down, and it gathers right there in that one particular spot.
You know, that's interesting to me. Up in New Mexico, I've got a friend up there that I've hunted mule deer with a few times, and there's a spot on his place that the mule deer and the elk come to. He showed it to me, and he didn't really have the answer, but he said, I mean, he could just look like a salt lick. Maybe it was a salt lick, a natural salt lick. I don't know. But he said there's some mineral in there, and, man, it just like a, you know, feeding site for cattle or something.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. Natural.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, before people were putting out supplemental stuff, well, critters knew where to.
They do.
They've probably been, I don't know, they might have been hitting that eons
ago. They probably have. Probably have.
Yeah.
And it's funny you talk about that. We had a little ranch up there in Georgia, because we're from Florida, and I moved out here 11 years ago to take over this ranch and run it. Mm-hmm. And in Georgia, they have salt blocks that are natural salt blocks that we put out for the deer up there, and they loved them. So I brought some out here and put them around at our feeder sites. They wouldn't touch them. Never touched them. So I just loaded them up, carried them back to Georgia.
Exactly.
But I don't know why. The deer out here just wouldn't eat them.
They don't have to, because they got that little spot.
And it very well may be.
You know, that's crazy. The thing about salt, and I've seen this happen, and it's a good case in point. By my house for 17 years, a mile from my house, I had access to hunt tons of hogs. It's in the Trinity Basin, you know,
right,
a lot of water to hunt these hogs. And I put out salt blocks. And, you know, the deer, you'd think just deer, but hogs love it too.
Well, they sure do.
So I was away from, I lost access to the place where I can't hunt it anymore. Well, 2 years later, I went back in there, the new owners and all, and they let me back in there to get my stuff off, right? My feeders and all that. Where I had been putting that salt for years, as a whole, you know, the hogs had really created a like a little wallow or somewhat there, and they dug in. There was, I'm not kidding you, 2 years later, it had been a rain, the soil was wet, hog tracks everywhere in there, in that hole. Yeah, I mean, I hadn't put any salt in there in a couple of years.
But it just kind of naturally leached in there,
yeah, right? Yeah. So a salt, I guess a natural salt lick would be the same thing.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
well,
yeah.
Yeah, that's like those antelope over there. Once that block was gone,
they were in that ground.
They just went into the ground right there where it was at. Just
they know, I guess a wild critter knows that kind of
stuff. And I got a spot where I'll put salt blocks on my place, and when they're gone, I'll put another one there. But now it's almost like a crater.
Oh yeah.
I mean, they've dug it up, the deer and the hogs, and of course I've got a trail cam there, so I know what's going in there. But
yeah,
they love it. They'll go in there, and when those blocks are gone, they'll start eating that dirt.
I'm not sure you couldn't, if that's all you had. you can hunt over that salt and do pretty good.
You could. Well, we're talking about this. I know we got people listening to this from different states. You really want to check your local regulations, because in some areas we're not allowed to do any supplemental feeding, any kind of baiting. And in some areas, salting in an area is considered baiting. So
yep.
I would suggest very much to pay attention to what we're saying. But before you go out and say, man, I need to put out a whole bunch of salt on my place, check your local regulations to see whether or not your state does allow you to do that kind of thing.
Good point. But if you're in Texas, go get you some salt blocks, right, Larry?
Absolutely. I mean, we're fortunate here in Texas that we've got some very progressive and understanding game laws when you get right
exactly.
down to it. And I think a big part of that comes down to the fact that we're 95% privately owned, and therefore what wildlife exists pretty much exists on private land, and anything we can do to enhance that land for wildlife, you know, for the most part, the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department and other state regulatory situations involved, I guess, you know, let us do a lot of things. But thank God we live in Texas, kind of thing.
You bet.
Jeff, how many times have you been out in mule deer country?
Well, in Texas, this is the first time I've hunted in Montana.
Right.
I have a friend that has a ranch in northern Montana. I've hunted mule deer up there and shot one. But here, this is the first time, and this country is amazing. John, you have one heck of a beautiful place here.
Thank you.
And to see these animals out here in the hills and just the terrain, it's just one amazing place. Absolutely.
Thank you very
beautiful.
Much.
Kind of breathtaking in a lot of different ways. And I promise you, if we were walking these mountains right now, it would be breathtaking. It would be my breathtaking.
I've had more fun with my cameras, my video and my still cameras over this last couple of days, taking pictures and video. Just absolutely stunning.
It is. This country is, it's a high desert. It's a dry, arid, thirsty country when you get right down to it. And I want to come back. A lot of these draws, as we've been driving in some of these low spots, John, you keep pointing out where there were people that lived here many, many years ago. And apparently the water table at one time, before we did all the irrigating and all that kind of thing farther north, the water table was probably a lot higher, and a lot of these little draws and creeks probably ran. But we're not the first people to be in this country, are we?
No, I've found literally hundreds of Indian campsites, or a lot of them, what we have here are paleo and archaic sites, which predate what we commonly know as the Indians or Native Americans. And I call them the ancient ones.
Yes, sir, I agree.
That's just my story with them, is the ancient ones. And yeah, the campsites typically you find where they're on the north sides of these creek beds, these draws and stuff. And all the caves that are here on the ranch that they use, they'll all be on the south-facing slopes where they get that, in the wintertime, they were getting that sun out of the south, and the wind's coming out of the north and northwest, so they were out of the wind and into the most sun. And it's interesting to just, as we were doing today, I was riding along there and stopped and backed up, and he's wondering what I saw, if I saw a deer or something, and no, I didn't see a deer. I saw an arrowhead laying there,
well,
so I stopped.
You really messed me up for the rest of the trip, I want to tell you, because I love hunting for artifacts and all those kind of things. And I'm off looking off in the hills, you know, with deer over here, and John's over looking at the ground. Finally, we stop, we back up. Sure enough, he picks up, you know, a scraper and a point and all that kind of thing, laying there just in the road, not close to water or anything. And the next thing he's pointing out, you know, if the sun's hitting right, you can see the sun glinting off the, you know, the chips of the chert and the flint. So I quit looking for deer off in the hillsides. Now I'm looking at the
ground.
Got
sidetracked, you know. Yeah.
Over the years, I used to hunt South Texas, old brush country, a lot. And that country there, too, has been inhabited by some form of man for many, many years. And I'd find a broken point or find a midden or something like that, and I'm looking at the ground, and I have no idea how many big bucks I've walked by. I know several that I surprised and surprised me, because I was looking at the ground and all of a sudden would stand there looking at you, kind of thing. You go, oh God, if I'd just been looking where I was supposed to, I could have had a chance at that buck.
Yeah. Well, arrowhead hunting, it's a very habit forming. Once you find your first piece and your eyes get trained to look, like say I was riding along there and running 10, 15 miles an hour and all of a sudden I see this piece and I back up and, you know, I could see, I saw that it was worked.
Right, you see.
As I went by, I could see the flaking in it.
Yeah, the flaking or the fluting on it, yeah.
And but
So John, on the right behind us here on the hill is a cave. So up right near that cave, have you found quite a few arrowheads up on that? I would assume you probably
We found a lot up there, and the goats get up there, and they'll paw them out of a spot in the ground where they can lay down. They'll paw the rock out of the way and lay down in it because it's blocked from the wind a lot up there. You go up there every few months, and you'll see where they've dug out a new spot, and you'll find a point laying there a lot of times.
One thing that interesting to me is a dugout. You was talking about somewhere.
Old dugout homestead.
Well, that'd been like maybe the 1800s or...
18.
Yeah.
Most likely.
And it was common back in those days, I've read, to dig a hole in there and put some timbers around it.
Right.
That's kind of what it is here.
There's some of the posts that you still see sticking up out of the ground around one of them. And
it'd be hard to imagine how tough those people had, how hardy those people had to be to live there.
You know, though, everything's relative.
Right.
They didn't know about running water. They didn't know about propane. They didn't know about electricity. So, to them, they may have been thinking, I'm in this dugout. I'm in high cotton.
Central heat there.
We're in the ground, and by golly, the wind's not going to hit us here, and it's going to stay cooler in the summertime.
They had to look at it like that.
So, like I said, they didn't know, for one of us to go back and live that way, it'd be tough.
Well, you talk about the Pueblo and the heat and the central air and heat and all the over in New Mexico, over there where we're at, there were a lot of the Pueblo Indians over there.
Yes, sir. Right.
Which are, they're 1,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. And found pits where they had their complex of Pueblos around their little community, their little towns. And there'd be a big pit dug there. And at the bottom of those pits, there's a rectangular, usually most of them I've seen, are a rectangular hole, looked like a brick that you put on the side of your home.
Yes, sir.
And those things had little tunnels that went off, and they'd come up in the rooms of the other buildings around it, and they'd have a fire down in that big pit.
So
and that was their heating system.
They had central heat to get right down.
About 1,000 years ago, and it just totally amazed me the first time I ever saw it.
Now, that's interesting.
That is.
In other words, in the bottom of this hole, there'd be a duct system from...
Oh, the hole would be 6-8 foot deep down there. Most of them that I've seen were a round circle. It would be 10-12 foot across, 6-8 foot deep. And try to figure out what's this for, and then get walked around looking at some of the ruins, and you find a ruin, and here's a little hole that comes up out of the bottom of
it. Right, I've seen that. I don't know what you're talking about.
And it's just like an air conditioner duct.
Right.
Like it's in this mobile home here we're in right now. Comes up out of the ground, and the heat would... That's the only thing it could be.
Yeah. That's pretty amazing.
It is real amazing when you think about it. And too, they'd have irrigation systems set up, all over some of those areas.
Right.
In terms of getting water. And again, the water tables were a lot higher than they are now. And so they didn't have to dig as deep, or there were natural springs coming out of a lot of these places. One time, too, probably, you'd mentioned, Mr. John, there were buffalo in this country as well, too.
Right.
And I would assume there was a fair number of black bears scattered in through here.
I'm sure there was years and years and years ago. But of course, naturally in Texas, there were elk, which became extinct, and then they reintroduced them and stuff.
Yeah.
And,
there were Merriam's elk, which are some of the bigger antlered, bigger bodied deer elk there were. And there's somebody, you talk to the right person over on that White Mountain Apache area there in Arizona, New Mexico, they say that those probably are remnants of the Merriam subspecies as opposed to the Canadensis and
probably,
other subspecies.
Probably the elk that are around that Gila over in the New Mexico.
Yes, sir, that from Gila over into Arizona right there, because that Apache reservation is not that terribly far.
Because truly, you look at that place over there, and you don't typically think of it being elk country.
No, that's
everybody
right.
thinks of elk country, your high country, your aspens, and your black timber, spruce, and everything, more so than cedar. Cedar Ridge country.
Well, I know you don't, probably don't have any on this ranch, but there's elk scattered all over this western part of the state, and particularly a little bit farther south and a little bit farther west down in, you know, the Glass Mountains. And
6-8 miles south of me right here, a friend of mine, he's got some elk on his place and just free range.
Yeah, I mean, and these bulls here, of course, they're in the state of Texas, they're considered exotic, even though they were native in this country at one time. As a result of that, there is no specific hunting season. You can hunt them year-round. Landowner permission. And so a lot of these hunts here in Texas are right during the peak of the bugling season, where you can hunt them with a rifle, bow, handgun, muzzleloader, crossbow. It doesn't make any, you know, whatever. And they're taking some really big bulls. There's not uncommon in some of these areas to shoot 400 class bulls.
Yeah, there's some big ones around.
I've seen numerous elk down there in the Glass Mountain country there, just north of Marathon. They were absolutely big bodies. And then you go down farther into the Big Bend there, the National Park area, and we've seen them down there in the Chinatis and the Chizos and all those areas
over that area.
Yeah, they all scattered in through it. Throughout that area, kind of thing.
Like I say, I'm from Florida originally, born and raised there, and moved out here 11 years ago, and I'm still learning about this country, and I put in a lot of work to learn to hunt this country here on our ranch, and keep up with what's going on where. And a lot of times, you know, I've got certain bucks I pick out that I pattern, and
right,
I know where they're going to be and when they're going to be there.
And then sometimes they throw you a curve.
And sometimes they throw us a big curve. This weather these last couple of weeks has been crazy.
Well, you actually had a substantial snow here not very long ago. I was farther east here a little bit. We had a sleet more than anything else to have snow, but then a lot of the other part of the state of Texas.
We had 12 inches of snow here on the ranch, and a lot of the people that's been here all their life, lived right here in this little area all their life, had never seen it like that. And I got the bright idea that I'm going to go up on top of the mountain up there and check some things out. And didn't pan out too well. That 4-foot deep drifts up there, and those Polaris Rangers don't play well in the snow like that.
No.
I spent 30 minutes digging it out where I could get back on some solid ground to go back down the mountain.
With the snow, did you see any game movement much, or did they kind of hold tight? Or?
No, they locked down like I've never seen. Yeah. And they're still not moving like they were, because this weather's been crazy. Yeah. I mean, cold. We've been in the 20s every night just about. And during the peak of that storm, we were at 11 degrees and below that for several days. And they just did not move. You wouldn't see one anywhere. And I had a hunter that I just kept apologizing to him, because, I mean, they're always here, but they're not here right now. And luckily, good Lord shined down on us, and the last day of his hunt, we got him a nice mule deer that morning, and went that afternoon and got him a nice whitetail.
You know, John, that's one thing that impressed me. John has been a guest on my radio show several times.
I think three times, four
times.
Yeah,
it's going to be more. Now we got a lot to talk
Amen.
About. You know, but the fact that you offer... for a person looking for a place to hunt, free range, wild country, I don't know a better place, but you offer hunts for mule deer, combo hunts, if they want to stay, I think you said, I don't know, 6 or 7 days.
6 days, 7 nights.
And it would take that in wild open country to hunt, get you a mature whitetail or a mature desert mule deer. Man, that's just, you know, that's something right there. That I will personally highly recommend, man. Somebody mm-hmm. looking for a place to hunt.
Good accommodations, you know? Just a fantastic place.
Just a good free range hunt.
You know, we're not a 5-star. I mean, if you're looking for a 5-star location, this is not it. I mean, now if you want 5-star hospitality, we aim to please with that.
Well, that's a fact. But like us, you know, we like to cook, you know, camp cooking and all that, and man, it just doesn't get any better as far as I'm concerned. You know, have our stuff cooked up and
got it.
Cook a little while we're here and have a good time, man.
Well, our hunters, they have that option. You know, if they want to do their own cooking, that's great. The stove, pots and pans, dishes, everything's here. spices, the whole nine yards is here. If they want to do it, if they don't want to cook, then we'll hook you up and we'll do the cooking for you when you come in, and there'll be a hot meal ready to go, and
yep.
You don't have to worry about it.
Yeah. Cater to whomever, right? You know, whatever they want.
We try to, you know, we work around with them and how they want to do it, and a lot of people said that, you know, we're too cheap. Well, maybe so, but it makes us happy.
Well, since we're talking about prices, what are your prices on your hunts?
Well, like that hunt Mr. Luke was just talking about, we do, if we do a six-day hunt, seven night, we're talking like $5,000, that place to stay, we feed you, everything, cleaning, boning out your meat, getting it bagged up, ready to go, caping your animal out. If you want it caped out, we'll cape it out. If you just want a Euro mount, we'll fix it for a Euro mount, get it ready to take to whoever you want to finish the process, because don't have the time usually with a hunter here to get everything done like right. that. But we'll get it ready to go to taxidermist or whoever to do that stuff. And, you know, and we do varied hunts, you know, just a normal, you know, like a four-day hunt or something like that, you know, for one animal, whether it be whitetail or mule deer. We do a $2,500, and that place to stay, you do your own cooking. Like I say, if you decide you want to do that other, then my wife usually does the cooking, and, you know, pay her to do the cooking for you. She'll get all the food and prepare it and everything. And if you first day out, first morning out or whatever, and you get a nice whitetail, say, and, well, I'd like to go try to get a mule deer now. Okay, well, $1,500 trophy fee to go out and get the second one. And we usually, a lot of times, we'll throw in the doe with it. You know, just on top of everything else.
Yes, sir. That's fantastic. Yes,
it really is. Yeah. Knowing after being hunting here and taking a nice mule deer buck, you know, I mean, I've nothing wrong with the mountain states. I love Colorado and all that. You compare what you've got here, John, with going to Colorado and putting in your draw and waiting, all that. You've got the permit. You've got the permit for them, and all they have to do is just show up. And
holds true over in New Mexico. We do the hunts over in New Mexico by state law over there. Their law, you get you pick three consecutive days to do your antelope hunt. Now, we do over there, I do $3,000 place to stay. I feed you, cape the animal out, bag the meat up and all that stuff. And, $3,000 for a 3-day hunt. And I just won't let anybody just shoot any antelope. That I like to manage them. Mm-hmm. Most of them don't. Most places don't. If you said there's an antelope shooting,
right?
No,
right.
I don't do that. Right. I look at him as no. Nah, let's go find something else.
Yeah, let's get a trophy. And for trophies, yeah.
We're going. It will be a good trophy. You know, mm-hmm. A lot of 75 inch up more normally is.
It's good antelope.
It takes 80 inch to make Boone and Crockett. And we've killed some that's way up there. We've killed some monsters.
Could I bring a little be around me very long, you're going to probably talk about some camp cooking.
Yeah.
But I've got a question here that I don't know the answer to. I've cooked all kind of venison, you know, and elk and even bear. You know, I've cooked, it's not hard to do. I've never prepared pronghorn antelope. I know nothing about it. I've eaten it one time, and I'll say this, the way it was prepared at that time, maybe they didn't take care of the meat right. Venison was better. How about eating I'm talking about taking care of the meat right and everything.
Well, we've only had that ranch over there 7-8 years now, maybe. And I knew absolutely nothing about antelope.
Okay.
Antelope's not good to eat. Well, I'm going to try it. I don't care what it is. Oh, yeah. I'll try anything once.
Me too.
Much. Except for rattlesnake.
I don't want a rattlesnake either.
I ain't going to eat no rattlesnake. But I cook it. Pretty much all the meat that I cook, wild game, I guess it's a free commercial pitch for whatever. I use Lowry seasoning salt, garlic powder, and flour. That is it.
Chicken fried, right.
I mix my seasoning salt and my garlic powder in with my flour and get it all shook up real good, and I'll taste it till I get it where my taste buds think it need to be.
Yep.
And like I say, part of a lot of it maybe is preparation. I get the animals as fast as I can, get it back, get it cleaned out, get it cooled off, washed down, cooled off, and, you know, then I cut it up to flour and fry it. And like I say, I do, it don't matter whether it's deer, bear, elk, antelope, all dad I've had told me all dad's not any good. I found out why. Everybody wants to kill the biggest ram they can find.
There you go. Sure.
And they're like chewing a shoe. They're tough. Now you get a young ram or a ewe, and that is some of the good eating.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yep.
And, but then again, Lowry seasoned salt, garlic powder, flour.
That's it.
Bare basics.
And it is, I think, outdoor camp cooking is what I call it. Like this mule deer, this buck, I already know a very simple way is, you know, he's probably not going to be as tender as a young doe. Go ahead and I'll use a little deal called a jacquard. It's got a bunch of little needles in it. Or a meat hammer, you know, an aluminum meat hammer. Mm-hmm. And then I'll put basically, just like you're talking about, John, very similar to the same season, as long as I got some extra garlic powder in there. But I'll also take a little Louisiana hot sauce, put it in a Ziploc bag, dump a little of that in there. I don't know if that helps that much, but it's got a little vinegar in it, so maybe it helps. And then I'll let it sit a lot of times, you know, a few hours or overnight or 2 or 3 days, to be honest with you. And then I'll put it in you take a good old cast iron skillet, put your little olive oil in there, maybe chip you a little jalapeno up in there with it, and some fresh garlic, cloves,
little
and then you slap those steaks. Mm-hmm. I tell you, that's some of my favorite eating.
I've got one. You may have done it before, and I just kind of stumbled across it. It's a Mexican marinade called Mojo Carrillo. You shake the bottle up, and you say, that's nasty looking stuff. I'll take the back strap. I'll cut it, you know, about an inch thick, and then I'll cut that piece in half where we got like maybe two
butterfly
pieces. I'll marinate it, put it in a Ziploc bag, marinate it and that stuff overnight. Just get it in there. I pour a whole quart bottle of it in that bag and just marinate it in that overnight. Take that stuff out, get you some good bacon. Don't use cheap bacon. Get you some good bacon.
Yep.
Usually take and cut the strip in half, wrap it around that piece of meat, put a toothpick in it. Get your barbecue grill hot as you can get it. Take that stuff, and I've got my grill's probably about 3 foot so wide. I'll start laying them all down right on that hot grill. Get them all lined up across there. Pretty much come back and then flip them all over one time. Pink. You want it pink in the middle. Any wild game you cook, if it's not pink in the middle, it's overcooked. It gets tough. It gets chewy. And a lot of people don't like wild game because people tend to overcook it. Mm-hmm. And that stuff, your lips will beat your face apart trying to get another bite of it.
Good eating. I'll have to get some of that. I mean, I will.
It is super. I mean,
what's in it? You know? Do you have any idea?
I have no clue. I think they put the kitchen sink in there.
Everything, huh?
It's got everything.
Big jar, you say?
It's a quart bottle, like a fifth whiskey bottle, whatever.
Easily, can you find it pretty easy out in this country?
Well, they didn't used to have it at our little old grocery store here in town, and I asked them about getting it, and they can't keep it on the shelf nowadays.
Is that right?
Everybody's got
used. Maybe a product of Mexico, or who knows?
I don't know.
I've got to have some. That's why I'm being so inquisitive.
Sounds good.
You got to have it.
It is.
You have to look it up and Google it, I guess.
Yeah, I'll have to get John to write it down for me. I've already forgotten.
You know, I was talking about cooking the meat pink. I had some hunters come in from Indiana, and I was doing a wild game cook. I had some elk. I had bear. I think I had some antelope and deer meat. And he said, well, what are you cooking? I told him all that, you know, elk, deer, bear. Oh, bear, you don't have to cook no bear for us. We just come back from Canada, and we had bear up there where we killed some bear, and they cooked it up there, and we don't like bear. I said, just take one bite of mine and then tell me you don't like it.
There you go.
They sat down, and they eat, and they got a piece of that bear meat and said, this don't taste nothing like the way we did it. I said, the old Indian guy, Native American in Colorado, in 1976, come over where I was cleaning one and asked me what I was going to do with it. I told him I'm going to eat it. And he said, son, make sure you get every last scrap of fat off that meat before you fry it, or you won't be able to eat it. And that's the way I've always done it. Cleaned it, no fat, and always pink in the middle.
Yeah.
It's always tender. I killed a big old boar bear. I mean, his teeth are wore down. He's so old, but you can't tell it. It's just as tender as it can be.
Sometimes it's what they eat.
I don't even tenderize it.
No, just cook it right.
I just...
Like with bears, sometimes what they eat, I know some that eat fish and then some that eat berries, and you're going to get different flavor.
Well, if you get that fat off there, that's where your flavor's at, is in that fat.
Yeah.
You like it. You know, venison, a lot of people don't realize it, but the last thing you want is venison fat when you're cooking. That's where the... You know, people say the gamey taste, especially right. In a buck, but you trim that fat, all of it off.
Well,
in that silver skin and all that.
In this country here, you know, lots of cedar trees, and they eat them cedar berries and stuff, and
yeah. And
that's where the flavor is, like mm-hmm. You say, it's stuck in that fat. And sometimes these deer here that we've killed here, they'll have 1.5-2 inches of back fat on them.
You told me the one I shot, like if I'd have killed him, two or three weeks ago. I thought he was a very healthy deer. Big old hams on him, you know. But you said he'd have been somewhat heavier.
Oh, yeah, he would have been, before that rut started and they got running 24/7.
Yeah.
You know, chasing does.
That old deer had a big old neck on him, you know, probably a 3-year-old.
Hawk smelled a little bit, too.
What now?
His hocks.
When
we picked him up, I grabbed him by the hock by accident. My hand smelled like hock for 2 days.
Here's something else I learned. I don't know a lot about mule deer at all, but I learned this from Larry and you. I asked this question, you know, okay, well, I looked at the hocks on a deer, and I can look at the hocks on a whitetail. A 3.5-year-old is going to have some black hocks. They're going to start getting black, and, you know.
Right.
This deer was probably a 3.5, I think y'all told me. That's what I thought he was, too, when I shot him. But I looked, and the hocks were dark, brown, a little black, but they weren't black and waxy like a 3-year-old whitetail buck.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So that's typical of mule deer, I guess.
Yep. Pretty much.
Yep. Well, that's neat.
But Mr. Larry's the expert on that. Don't ask me.
It's a learning process every time you go out and hunt.
You pick up some information.
Oh, you really do. And to me, one of the great things is sitting around at hunting camps that we've been able to do in the evening a little bit and just listen to people's stories and things like that. It's amazing what you can learn.
Yeah, well, that's, absolutely. You know, first time I ever met you, you know, that I was trying to pick your brain on stuff because I had read your articles, I'd seen your shows on TV, and never had the pleasure of meeting you. And that day that I did get to meet you, and we've kind of been friends ever since.
Yeah.
I haven't left you alone a lot. I've called you and talked to you on the phone and email and stuff.
That was an absolutely perfect thing because I was a speaker at the Mule Deer Foundation
right
there in Fort Stockton, and I know you've been very much involved with that organization as well in several different ways, as have I, and it's an absolutely fantastic group of people.
It's top of the line, and the biggest thing about that Mule Deer Foundation chapter is all about kids. Most every other chapter, and it may be the only one that's pretty much dedicated to the kids that I know of in the state of Texas, for
it's
sure.
It's the only one that I know of, and as we're sitting here talking, we're in the little camp, and I'm looking up on the wall, and it says Texas Youth Hunting Program, and it gives several years, you know, with the Easton Ranch name on it, and you guys have been involved with that Texas Youth Hunting Program now for several years.
We do that. We bring in fact, they were here just before you got here. We bring them in every year. I'm all about kids. Started out with my own boys. They were actually my stepson, and I raised them. They're mine. they slipped in here the other day and really shocked me and surprised me. I didn't know they were coming. And kind of got me all choked up thinking about it right now. And but it's all about the kids. And
it is.
I get a bigger thrill out of taking a kid out hunting than anybody else.
Well, that's such a fantastic program. We started, I was involved with the formation of the Texas Wildlife Association. And through the Texas Wildlife Association, we formed the Texas Youth Hunting Program. And I haven't seen the latest figures for this year, but we've taken somewhere in the neighborhood of 35,000 kids on hunts throughout the state of Texas. And I think the total number, that when you look at people introduced, meaning that that child has to come with a parent or guardian, sometimes they have never been out in the outdoors to speak of. And so when you look at it in that respect, there's always one there. So when you take that 35,000 kids, we're actually talking about 70,000 people that we've introduced to hunting through the Texas Youth Hunting Program through Texas Wildlife Association.
I know this year when I was talking to the hunt master that was with this group of kids that he had called me about it and said, you know, are you still? I said, yeah. I said, we're going to do it. I said, I'm not worried about any of this nonsense going on. But a lot of the programs didn't do it because of all this COVID.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm actually, when I leave here, I've got to go down to close to Harper, which is a little town outside of Fredericksburg and Kerrville, to speak to a group of youth hunters that they've got in place there that we'll get a chance to spend some time with the young men and young ladies, and then, of course, their parents and guardians as well, too. And I've done several of those in the past, and they're so rewarding in so many different ways.
It is. Well, I mean, we've had groups out here where we've had the father and son, but also a grandfather and another son. They come where both of the kids can hunt. And we've had some that have been out here, and they go online when it's time to sign up again, and they look for the hunt so they can come back.
Yeah, they want to come back, and I can understand.
I can't blame them.
they love this country out here. And
truly unique in so many ways.
I take them out, and I'll show them some of the – I've got a creek bottom right over here by the – not too far from the house here that over the years it has washed through an old Indian campsite, or the ancient ones really, because the charcoal and ash from their fires is 6 foot deep or so through there, and it's 30, 40 foot wide.
Man.
And you know, a campsite like that was hundreds or thousands of years to build up
to accumulate that much, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Because, these people around here, they were nomadic. They followed the game. Wherever the game went, they went. And as the game migrated, they went with them, and they come back to these places year after year after year.
Yes, sir.
And
I can't think of a better history lesson for a child or even an adult. Me, just being here, seeing this stuff and whatnot is just, I mean, there's a lot of lessons, you know, looking at, you know, what's happened here in the past and, yeah. And you know, the Indian, you know, the sites that you've shown us and the arrowheads and the things you find out here and the history. There's just so much here, and it's just pretty incredible.
Well, it's unfortunate. I mean, back when I was in school 40 plus years ago, you actually learned history and stuff. Now, it's non-existent. So
they try to deny the fact that there was history here. Like,
right.
A lot of times, unfortunately, that we live in some interesting times, quite frankly. We're going to kind of close this thing out here just a little bit, because I want you to go show us that site that you're talking about down here behind, below the house. But before we close this thing out, John, how does somebody get in touch with you? Whether it's hunting whitetail, mule deer, individually, combination here in Texas, or pronghorn antelope out in New Mexico, what's the best way to contact you?
My home phone number is area code 432-836-4527. My cell phone is area code 863-781-1254. If Florida pops up when you do that one, Don't worry. Also, email it JW Eason@hotmail.com. And I'm on Facebook also for the time being. And you might find me on there, Eason Ranch, on there. But those are the ways to contact me, and we can talk. I prefer the phone over the texting and the typing, because me and computers don't play well together.
with that said, too, Luke, I want to get you to fill us in, because I saw you going, raising your finger. Me, I love it. But yeah, tell them through the radio and some of the other things that
you
we do.
The main thing, you know, folks, that I would like you to know, you can watch this hunt, and you can meet Mr. Eason, A Sportsman's Life, which is on Pride Outdoor Network. It was actually, not to be bragging, but it was a top show the last month, A Sportsman's Life, that Larry is with us on. Jeff and I have been doing a while. Larry's been with us now for a long time. Mm-hmm. But Jeff, tell them how Sportsman's Life, YouTube is just like a storage place for it. It's on Facebook, too, but A Sportsman's Life is a good place, right?
Right. You can just go to, if you have Roku or some streaming mechanism, go to the streaming channels under sports, and you'll find Pride Outdoor Network, and we are on there. You can also find us on YouTube, just A Sportsman's Life. If you put it in the search engine, you'll find us there. There's links on your website, catfishradio.org. You can find it there, or you can even find it on my website, buckandbassranch.com. But there's all sorts of ways to find us. Just Google Sportsman's Life, you'll probably find us out there. So, but yeah, this show will come up in the next week or two. And John, we thank you so much for allowing us to come out and enjoy this beautiful piece of God's country. It's been amazing.
It's been a pleasure. I mean, I've talked to Mr. Luke on the phone several times and did a couple radio shows over the phone with him, never met him personally. I guess we met through Mr. Larry, talking with him, and it's been a real pleasure meeting y'all, have y'all here, and we've had a lot of laughs. I mean, it's like I say, not a five star accommodations, but we have five star hospitality. We're going to have.
I don't beg to differ with you. It's way beyond that five star.
Oh yeah, I would agree. I second that.
I'll fart it in a cooler full of. I'm just sitting here thinking about some good mule deer steaks right now.
Is there a thing about some
recipes? We really do. You and I started. We got to be friends before I came here talking.
Right.
Just felt very comfortable having you on the radio show and. Want you to do that a whole lot more.
Amen.
And my writing through the years and the radio and everything else is not just Luke went somewhere and did something. Well, okay, I kind of have to do that to do what I do. But the fact that I get to hook people up with a place like this, that's what really rings my bell. So, you know, thanks a lot, man.
Part of our thing is, I mean, here we've got hunters that they came out. Some of them been coming out 10 or 12 years now. They come back every year, and they, like I told Mr. Larry yesterday, I had a real good friend I went to school with. We graduated together, football together, rodeoed together, and back in Florida, and he was about to cry because he couldn't make it out here this year.
Yeah.
And he just...
I can understand that.
He said, I look forward to that every year. More than anything is being able to come out here. It's peaceful. It's quiet. It's, you know, like I say, it's unique.
This is absolutely fantastic country, and you're such a fabulous host, and the animals that are here just are beyond compare. So thank you very much. One of the things I need to remind people of, this year, unfortunately, we're not going to be able to be in person at the DSC convention. And we're having a virtual event, and you can find out more about that, to where you can bid on hunts, find out, listen to the speakers, learn about whoever's there, and so many other things. And to learn about that, go to www.biggame.org. That's www.biggame.org. And have a look to see what's there. The site is up and running. That event's going to take place, I think, starting the 10th of February through the 13th or 14th. And we really need your support. Need everybody's support. DSC is the finest
conservation hunting organization there is in the world, and without you as our members and your support, we're not going to be able to do what we've been able to do in the past. And with some of the situations we're facing right now, not only here in North America, but worldwide, we really need the support of everybody that we can get who loves the outdoors, who loves hunting, who loves animals, whether you hunt or not, whether you fish, whatever. We need your support. So please learn more about us at www.biggame.org. And we'll see everybody here and maybe be around the campfire next week.
Mr. Larry, here's one thing. Let me throw this one at you right quick before we go.
Please.
You're talking about DSC and they're doing their auctions for their hunts and all. How about we throw a hunt in there? Pronghorn antelope in New Mexico with you for this coming hunting season.
We're going to sit down with this as soon as I sign off, and we're going to make that official. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Again, everybody, we'll see you all right back here next week. Don't forget to watch the Sportsman's Life. You can watch it on Roku, as our guys have said, but it's called the Sportsman's Life, and we're on the Pride Outdoor Network. You can sign up to it without any cost and watch us right there, and you'll actually be able to see some of the things that happen here on this hunt. See y'all next week.
DSC's Untamed Heritage is also brought to you by Texas Wildlife Association, working for tomorrow's wildlife today. Texas-raised hunting products, the Scent Gods, Kennetrek Boots for the trail less traveled, Wildlife Systems, serving hunters and landowners since 1987, Boyt, the finest in hunting gear, and Pyramid Air for all things air gun. Don't miss Mondays with Into the Blue, brought to you by Academy Sports and Outdoors. Every Monday night from 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV, the destination for outdoor entertainment.
I'm Will Cooper, host of Hunt Stand's Make Your Mark podcast. If you haven't already, download the free Waypoint TV app to listen to our podcast and watch the original films from Hunt Stand Presents anywhere, anytime, and on any device.